Hi, you're listening to Attention Plus on Talking Stuff Network. This is episode 35, and we are recording this on 7th April 2019. With the IPL in full swing and elections just around the corner, the best person to help us navigate through all this mess is our host, Arnab. So, hey, Arnab, elections or IPL? If you had to pick one choice of entertainment, which one would it be?
I would definitely pick the elections just because it happens once every 4 years. That's the reason. Otherwise,
like Olympics.
Yes. So
it's 5 years. You're talking about US.
Yes, I'm sorry. It happens every 5 years. So that gives it like five times IPL in. But with IPL, you can summarize 5 years as CSK won, RCB lost. So in a way, IPL, you can create a digest for IPL. It doesn't change a lot. But with elections, I think there is much more drama, definitely much more money at stake. It takes something really, really special to surpass IPL in terms of the amount of money at stake. But the Indian election definitely is the only thing that can surpass IPL in terms of the amount of money that will exchange hands before and after the elections. So this is, I don't know, it's a cynical way of saying it. Of course, it's all about democracy. But in a way, they're similar because I think that with IPL, the team that we support, it's not driven by what the team has done for us, but more how do we feel about that team. And some of it is basically we are affiliated with different teams, at least for some of us, the day we were born. So the day I was born, I was a Bengali from Kolkata, so I always will support Kolkata Knight Riders. That's it. There is no other objective reason why I should support Kolkata Knight Riders. True. And it's the same thing with elections. In India, the person you're going to vote for is determined for many people at their birth because of the religion and the caste that they're born into. Again, it's not a question of who can do more for me. Again, with IPL, I don't know. I mean, none of them can do anything for me. And some people would say that's true for Indian politicians too, that none of them will do anything for me. But we are passionately invested in politics and political parties and politicians in the same way we are invested in the IPL for no good reason, actually. So as I have said repeatedly in my podcast that people have asked me some, who do you think is going to win in Bengal or who do you think is going to win? How many seats do you think BJP is going to get? To be honest, I don't know because I always like to step back from things which I personally don't have the data for. We've seen last year so many of our political pundits, when Modi got elected, get it wrong. They got it wrong even after having the data because they put bias in the data. The Sardesais of the world called it wrong because they didn't want to believe the data. And that's the thing with data. You bring yourself into the data all the time. I mean, data is there, but your interpretation of data, and often there is, for those of us who work with data, know that often there is really no way around it. It is ultimately, the same data can be used to support for and against the exact same argument. So the thing is, the whole thing about lies, damn lies, and statistical lies, it's just that you can always massage the data, and you will unintentionally end up massaging the data because you want you want that as evidence for your wish fulfillment. There's something which you want. Sardesai does not want Modi to be the prime minister. Sardesai wants Congress to be in the prime minister. So he sees the data, that's ultimately how the data is going to be analyzed. So because I have my own biases and because I really don't have data beyond what I see on television channels, and why would I try to step on their toes? I personally don't have any predictions for this elections. All I can say is just by looking at the way elections work, and that I can say because history is obviously there, is that I believe, and again, I have no basis for saying this, but I believe that BJP will lose a lot of seats in Uttar Pradesh. And that I'm saying purely based on my understanding of the arithmetic. And I read this somewhere, so I don't have the citation and source for this. So please forgive me if I am misstating the numbers. But as far as I believe that the triumvirate of Muslims, Dalits, and Yadavs are the OBCs, they three to total, they account for about 40% to 60% of the electorate in pretty much all the constituencies of Uttar Pradesh. So these three, if you can get their votes, a significant number, you've won. It doesn't matter really what it doesn't matter what you've done or what you haven't done. It's really these three people, and it's really these three constituencies, I would say. And last time when the elections happened in 2014, because Akhilesh and Mayawati were opposing each other, I think in many of the constituencies, they polled, Akhilesh obviously polled higher than Mayawati, but they, I think, polled about 20% of this vote bank each. Now just put them together, they get 40%. There's no way that BJP has a path if you put them together. Now, of course, it's not obviously simple addition, additive arithmetic. There will be some people who will, because of that, move to the BJP. So there will be a finite A intersection B, which they might lose. So A union B minus the old A intersection B might happen. And again, that's why you cannot call it for sure. But just by looking at the sheer amount of votes that the coming together, the Mahagathbandhan, will get in Uttar Pradesh, I don't think that the BJP will be able to kind of compensate for that. Even if the Brahmin vote goes to them, I don't think, again, not an expert on Uttar Pradesh politics, but I just don't think that they are going to get it. And the rhetoric, I was shocked to see what I still want to believe that this is not true. But Akhilesh Yadav's proposal to tax upper caste families who make more than, I just don't even understand how that is even constitutional, that taxation can be determined by your caste, that extra taxation can be determined by your caste. I just don't even understand the constitutionality of it. Forget. And again, he has announced this and there is absolutely no outrage from our established media on this. There's absolutely zilch outrage. Can you just believe if BJP has done this to the constituencies which they know they are not going to get votes from, and say people from that will have to pay this? I mean, this would be, and rightfully so, this would be the headline. Except in some bizarre way, I think this is the way the liberals are going to look at it, is that this is reparations. What he's saying is reparations in this case. And that's the only way I can justify it. That something as bizarre as this is passing by without any mainstream comment. So is it because people believe that this is something which is just so out of the way that it's not going to get implemented? Or should we bring it back to the whole notion of the Overton window? Have we now opened? Is this now going to be part of our popular discourse? Where, again, by the way, for those who say, who might be thinking, oh, look, I'm not a Brahmin, okay? I'm not a Brahmin myself. So this does not affect me in any shape or form. I am, in Bengali terms, I would possibly be an OBC. But even then, I have no personal skin in the game. But even then, I find this outrageous. I found this outrageous that given our constitution, you can decide to tax somebody based on their caste. My mind boggles. But again, will Akhilesh be able to do it at the center? I doubt. I doubt they'll ever be able to do it. But which brings me to the main thing, that elections...
But there's another scary theme too, right, Arnab? You also saw the video of Sam Pitroda where he asked folks to just tighten up, and the middle class, essentially, they're saying that we are entitled and we need to pay more tax.
Yes, that is less scandalous than this. Because, you know, ultimately, first of all, Sam Pitroda is... I mean, who is Sam Pitroda? He's some sidey Congress guy with a bad beard. Akhilesh Yadav is different. Akhilesh Yadav is likely to emerge as one of the kingmakers, at least, after the election. So he is not somebody who you can just basically laugh away. Sam Pitroda, you can laugh away. I mean, even his interview, he looks like he's not quite there the way he talks. And again, what he articulates very... in a way, I would say, honestly, is the way that not just Congress, you know, even the BJP looks at the middle class, that they look at law-abiding, tax-paying citizens. I mean, I'm not saying that they're law-abiding by choice. They're law-abiding because they earn money from, you know, from a salary, and that is precisely calculated. So in a way, I'm not ascribing that they're particularly honest otherwise. But whatever it is, they, whether by compulsion or by choice, they're law-abiding citizens. And not only are successive governments absolutely gung-ho about taxing them, they feel that not only that, I mean, I think the arrogance comes from the fact that they feel that the middle class should be thankful for that, that by not paying, that they have not been paying their fair share, apparently, to this country. When the only people who have been paying any share has been the middle class, because they can't get away with it. The ultra-rich don't pay taxes, the poor don't pay taxes. So they're the people who pay, he's the only people who pay taxes. And this, Apple, we cannot use swear words, you know, please imagine an expletive. This man is basically saying that, you know, you should be ashamed that even you're asking this question. This is classic Congressism, that none of the Nehru-Gandhi family will, nobody knows how much tax they pay. They're insanely rich. Nobody knows how they're insanely rich. And their acolytes also, nobody knows how they make their money. And they have the gumption, they have the arrogance to then go and say, why shouldn't the middle class pay more to buy Rahul Gandhi his prime ministership? That's really all they're concerned about. So, you know, which brings me to the main point. That's really what I wanted to say about this election, is that ultimately it's all about emotion. When people go to vote, they vote on emotion. They don't vote on job numbers. They don't vote on GDP. They don't vote on the national debt. They just don't vote. They don't vote on the environment. They don't vote on healthcare. They get up in the morning and they, you know, who am I feeling it? You know, am I feeling it? So last election, there was a major feels for Narendra Modi. I think it transcended the party. I think that's where Modi decided, Modi and Amit Shah decided. And they've kind of kept at it, that the party or whatever used to be the party is not so much important as Narendra Modi himself, that Narendra Modi is the party. Now, this has obviously caused a lot of tension and emo blogs from Advani and, you know, Shatrughan Sinha leaving the BJP, because he's basically, both Amit Shah realizes that ultimately people go to vote on emotion. So all that they need is some kind of guy who gets people emotional, which is why the biopic is coming out, because it's all about emotion. That biopic would, as I have said, will work the other way around. If it actually sees the light of day, people will feel emotional for Rahul Gandhi or anybody else. But the point of the matter is that it's entirely about emotion. That's why BJP's message this time, and again, you can criticize it as much as you want, but ultimately what matters is, does it win elections? The whole thing about nationalism, national boundaries, you know, Pakistan, because these are very emotional issues. People, whenever they hear this, they react emotionally to it. And that's really been their only card. Unfortunately, as I also said, elections in India are also, just like IPL, people support certain parties just because they find their own caste identity represented in it. So I just don't see, you know, no matter how much they pump up or they blow hot air into the emotional balloon, that they are going to be able to counter the sheer numbers of Mahagathbandhan in Uttar Pradesh. And they will find it tough. I don't know so much about Bihar per se, but for this very, very big example, just look at what's happened for Shatrughan Sinha and his Patna Sahib seat. So Shatrughan Sinha is now fighting that seat as a Congress candidate. He is going to get some of the, I think as far as I know, he's a Kshatriya. So he's going to get some of the Kshatriya votes again. Sorry if I'm wrong about this. I think, what's the name of the guy the Congress has put up, the BJP has put up against him? I can't remember.
No, I didn't know that they've announced anyone bigger for that.
Oh, yeah. So they have this. Hold on.
You have a better pulse on Indian elections than me. It's right here.
So you have Ravi Shankar Prasad, okay, who's, you normally see on televisions, and he's not particularly articulate also, who's never been local. I mean, he's never been local in the way that Shatrughan Sinha has been for Patna Sahib. he's being put up to fight against Shatrughan Sinha. Okay. Shatrughan Sinha, no matter what you can, I mean, he's asked zero questions. He's done nothing in parliament again, but that those things don't matter. Ultimately, when you put Shatrughan Sinha up on a stage, he has that charisma, that dialogue bazi to carry it off. Against who? Against a guy who can barely talk on television. So you're, plus, you know, he splits. I think the Ravi Shankar Prasad and these two guys must, you know, on the same cast. There is, he is not just by coming over to Congress, he's going to open up a constituency that he didn't have. And he is, that's really the reason why I think the BJP was kind of reluctant to move against Shatrughan Sinha for so long. Because he's kind of has that constituency in his pocket. He's basically a one constituency person. And now Congress gets that. It gets that purely on the basis of emotion. Shatrughan Sinha has done really nothing for his constituency. But again, it doesn't matter because he is going to be able to play
like
the...
Hema Malini again.
Yeah, again Hema Malini. She's done nothing. I doubt what people will get emotional over Hema Malini, but they'll definitely get emotional over Shatrughan Sinha because he's going to spin this as, look, I have been with the party from the 1990s and look what they did to me. So that's the kind of narrative that gets people to vote. It doesn't matter whether, you know, he spent 105% of his MPLAD fans' funds or, you know, that he never asked a question in parliament. It doesn't matter. Nobody cares about those things. They care about simple one-line narratives. When Rajiv Gandhi was voted into power, it was Indira Gandhi gave life for country, vote for Rajiv Gandhi. None of them were, you know, however you want to interpret it, he swept based on that one line. Nobody knew anything about Rajiv Gandhi and they voted for him. With Modi, it was Modi will stop corruption. That was Modi will stop corruption and give development. That was the emotive line. He swept the polls in a way nobody had since Rajiv Gandhi in 1985. So again, I don't think there is anybody has a kind of a winning narrative this time of that sort, which is why I think it's fairly obvious that the mandate will be fractured. There doesn't seem to be one person who has the killing message over here. I think that Congress's Modi government is a thief, chowkidar, chor hai, is not going to work. It is not going to work in the sense it worked for UPA too, because Rafale is a non-issue. It is an absolute non-issue. They could not prove anything on Rafale. Again, what do I think? Well, any kind of arms deal, especially of that scale, is always going to be shadowy. It always is. That's why novelists like me always like to build their stories around arms dealers, as I have done in Sultan of Delhi Part 2, plug. There's a reason for that. So it's never really above board. However, the Congress has failed to make the case in any shape or form that the Modi government took money from the Rafale deal. I think that is a non-issue. And I don't think right now the Congress is, to their credit, I don't think they're going in with that message. I think they are going in with a very, very socialist, we will give you more money kind of message. I think that is what they're trying to go with. They're trying to go with an emotional connect to, if Congress gets voted into power, you will get 6,000 rupees a month. So there is a direct cash transfer to your heart that's currently part of the Congress strategy. Again, will it work? It will definitely work for some delta voters. But for the vast majority of voters in India, they vote purely based on caste and their religion. Now, let me go back to a place where I know something about, Bengal. Why do people go out to vote? And why do I believe that, you know, sure, BJP will possibly make some percentage vote gains, but I doubt that BJP will be able to wrangle a significant number of seats from Mamata Banerjee. And because the reason for that is the only way the BJP could have made a case was that Mamata Banerjee is against Hindus. Now, unfortunately for the BJP, that, and I've discussed this in a previous podcast, this kind of thing works outside Bengal with people who don't know Bengal. But if you're in Bengal, you would definitely notice that Mamata Banerjee is very, 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 goes out of her way to cultivate the Muslim vote bank. But that does not cause any resentment per se, because she also goes out of her way to cultivate the Hindu vote bank. That's also true, that ultimately she goes out of her way to cultivate any vote bank. That's the major thing. You know, she's in that respect, she's secular. She will do anything for a vote. So it is not true, as Amit Shah like to say, or as that Hindus are scared of doing Durga Puja. If that was actually an emotional issue, I can tell you that Trinamool would lose every seat in Bengal, every seat. No party which has its basically own base in Bengal will ever touch Durga Puja. Okay, that's, if you do that, you're dead forever. Even the communists never did that. They knew where to draw the line. Now, will there be some movement for the BJP? There might be. But ultimately, Bengalis by nature will not vote for a party which is predominantly seen as a non-Bengali party, which does not have representation. Modi did a good thing, I would say, by kind of trying to appropriate Pranab Mukherjee as the only person, the only Bengali that he could appropriate. But ultimately, it doesn't work. Nobody really cares for Pranab Mukherjee either in Bengal. He was never really a mass politician. Nobody cared. I think, and this is important, is that BJP and none of the BJP leaders in Bengal are the kind of people who people can get emotional about. That's why I once said, until and unless BJP can rope in Saurav Ganguly, somebody like that, somebody you feel emotional for, they're not going to get votes. They're not going to get votes to Babul Supriyo. Nobody gives an F for Babul Supriyo. Nobody cares. I mean, that's why they want to put celebrities. And Trinamool has done it. They've put celebrities all over the place. They put celebrities all over the place. So just to make sure that you feel some kind of emotion for this person. And it's natural. When you watch somebody on screen for a long period of time, you become their fans. You kind of, that happens to all of us, which is again where the IPL thing comes from. You know, many people support Chennai Super Kings because they love Dhoni. There's no reason why, you know, Dhoni isn't from Chennai, but since they're fans of Dhoni, exactly the same reason why, you know, politicians cultivate movie stars. Because I'm a fan of this, I will support whatever party or whatever IPL team that person associates with. So with Bengal, this is the only prediction that I can make. I doubt that the BJP is going to make massive inroads. Yes, for the last 4 or 5 years, they have made some kind of an impact, in the sense that last time I was in Calcutta, I actually saw a BJP rally, which would have been unthinkable 10 years ago, that there would be anybody who would even declare themselves BJP and walk the streets. I remember when we were growing up, there was one guy in our locality who was perhaps the first person, you know, this was early 1990s, late 80s, Babri Masjid time. You know, he was a huge BJP guy, right? Whenever there would be a conversation, he would bring up BJP. And at that point of time, I remember my mother was very much involved in creating a garden. You know, my mother and all the other ladies wanted to, there was a part of the footpath which had been basically become appropriated by a garbage heap. So they wanted to remove that and make it into a garden. I remember one of my friends saying that if this gentleman was in charge of the garden, it would only be lotus flowers. So, you know, he was the first Bengali I'd ever seen who was public in his support for BJP. And this time I saw there were a lot of people. So part of it is because some Bengalis feel some kind of, you know, again, it's a personality of Narendra Modi, which attracts many Bengalis, that they feel. And that's a unique thing about Modi, and that love him or hate him, he does tend to become the person around whom the emotion is built around. And that's what gets people to vote, whether it's for Modi or against Modi. But he's somebody who you can feel emotional for. I doubt that Rahul Gandhi is a figure that you can feel emotional for. I mean, you can laugh at him, but I doubt that he's something you would feel emotional for. To their credit, the Congress have realized that. So from last time, that at least their digital strategy or their strategy has been much more putting Rahul Gandhi out to See, the problem with the Gandhi family is that for years they have been royalty. They have lived the life that the princes live. And it doesn't just extend to the way they talk or the way they move. It extends to the people they interact with. They've always kept this distance. If you look at, but Rahul Gandhi, after the previous elections, they've realized that this kind of elitism no longer works. So now I'm not talking about Rahul Gandhi going and having breakfast at Dalit's hut. So those are publicity stunts. Okay. Everybody does that. You know, we saw Hema Malini impeccably made up,
yes,
cutting the grain in a field. So, you know, that everybody does, you know, that's, you know, called kissing babies. Every politician has to do it. It's symbolic. You know, it's funny. Let's move on. But I have seen that the Gandhis have made an effort. Especially, I don't think Sonia Gandhi can do it. The royalty is too ingrained in her. She is a madam. And so, madam, if you looked at the Rajdeep Sardesai interview, there is this power dynamic which exists. And I don't think she can come out of it. But with Priyanka and Rajiv and Rahul, I keep on saying Rajiv. With Priyanka and Rahul Gandhi, they have deliberately tried to break that wall. They have understood that the reason why Narendra Modi is so popular is because people see in him an everyman. That whole Chaiwala thing, the people see in him a story that they can get emotional about. And those two, the brother and sister, also realize that their story is something which people can get emotional about, but in the wrong way. They represent everything that normal people hate. You know, a bunch of privileged princes and princesses. We like to read about them in fairy tales, but we don't like to vote for them. So what they're trying to do is they're trying to reach out. You can see that.
Humanize them.
They're trying to humanize themselves. They're trying to do their winking. They're going and hugging. You can see this. This is not spontaneous. Okay, this guy is not that guy. This is a carefully put on act, which is a little bit of a higher level act than, you know, cutting, you know, showing that, you know, I'm cutting grain in the fields. This is a higher level and more consistent act that they've been able to put forward. You know, now you see a lot of people, a lot of intellectuals, quote unquote, who for the last 4 or 5 years have been feigning, have been pretending to be politically neutral, have now come out of their little caves, and they're now openly sharing the Congress manifesto because they feel that the time has come to not be ashamed of the Congress anymore. That it's now time we understand that we love the Congress. And when people used to say, oh, you're basically a crypto-Congressy, they would say, no, why? Just because I'm against Modi doesn't mean I'm a crypto-Congressy. Well, right now you're basically tweeting the manifesto of Congress. I don't know how more Congressy you can get, actually. So what Rahul Gandhi and their gang have started, and I think they've done it with some success, is they've not only humanized themselves, but they've also made it not fashionable. It was unfashionable in 2014 to say that you supported the Congress. But gradually the stigma of supporting the Congress is gone. So, you know, people were obviously supporting the Congress. They still hadn't gone away. A Congress Mukt Bharat is never going to happen. But now again, they're proud of it. And that again comes back to the emotion. It is because people are feeling some sort of emotion. So summing up, caste arithmetic, BJP has lost it in Uttar Pradesh. They have lost the caste arithmetic. I think that they are going to, if not be wiped out in Uttar Pradesh, they are going to see a severe number of seats drop. And because of the sheer number of seats that Uttar Pradesh has, that could tip it this time. And that's,
of course, they're almost non-existent in South, barring maybe Karnataka.
Yes. And so that's always been the case. The only thing that they have going for them is Modi. The only thing that they have going for them is the personal cult of Modi. Good, bad, I leave it up to you to judge. But what I'm worried of is that will Modi be able to get, like, when the middle class Indians in the cities who kind of shift their votes, they are what the American political scientists call the swing voters. So when they wake up, will they feel it for Modi? Will they be able to forget demonetization? Because remember, the demonetization was something which really hit the urban population, the privileged population, much more than it hit the rural population. Rural people are used to standing in lines for everything. It's the people in the cities who are not used to. They're not used to that level of hardship in this day and age. There was a time in my when my parents were young when they were used to that also. You had to stand in line for everything. You had to go to Calcutta Electric Supply Corporation and pay your bill. You had to stand in a line to pay that bill. You had to stand in line to get gas. So standing in a line was considered to be a part of life. But now in these days, with everything being electronic and stuff, yes, automatic bill payer and everything, people don't stand in lines anymore. So have they been able to forget that fact that they stood in line? Because ultimately what happened was the kind of benefits that were touted that were going to come from demonetization never really happened. Corruption didn't vanish. Terrorism didn't vanish. So will people feel that, hey, it was worth it? I don't think so. So Modi has a lot of things working against him when it comes to that urban educated swing vote that he absolutely totally won in 2014. He just rocked that vote in 2014. I don't think he's going to. I mean, he's going to get some votes.
In fact, that's a good point you bring up. And Hyderabad, for example, we go to vote in the first phase. So I would be done voting by this time next week. We vote on Thursday. And just comparing this to 2014, I just don't see the buzz anywhere around. Because last year, in fact, in 2014, I think I was in Mumbai and I was also shuttling down to Hyderabad. So in both the places, I could see massive amount of publicity from both the parties. Almost every outdoor billboard was, 80% of them were BJP, and you had Congress, you had everyone doing it. I don't see any buzz this time around. I don't know whether it's, I would love to know from our listeners whether whether things are different and where they are. We have but at least here in Hyderabad, I just don't see any buzz. It's because it's a foregone conclusion on who's going to win locally, but like they say, maza nahi aa raha is, but I don't see that.
No, because I think it's a lack of emotion this time. So last time in 2014, there were two emotional items. One was the absolute failure of the UPA2 government in terms of corruption. We have a high tolerance for corruption, and UPA2 just went beyond that line. It was a Yuvraj 105 meter 6. That was what UPA2 had hit at that point of time. Every week there was some scam. Every week, something new. And so there was that emotion that these guys need to go. Okay, there was an extremely negative emotion from many people. Again, they said from the swing voters, there are some people for whom this doesn't matter at all. It's all about the caste of the guy who's standing in the elections or the religion. That's the only thing that matters. But for many people, this was. So when you're talking about excitement, this excitement wasn't there that, hey, guys, we need to vote these guys out. And the second thing was the novelty of Narendra Modi. Okay, the whole development agenda, the fact that, the thing with Narendra Modi last time was, I think people were not excited about LK Advani and, their gang of geriatrics. They were no longer excited about those guys. So Narendra Modi was new. He was a new generation. He was going to, he's a great communicator. He still is a great communicator. And he's the kind of guy for whom you can feel some kind of emotion for. So on one hand, you had the negative emotion for Congress. There was a negative vote, as well as there was a positive vote for Modi. This time, there's definitely going to be a negative vote against Modi, but it's not as emotional as it was last time. So the negative vote, there will always be some kind of anti-incumbency, but it's not to that level. On the other hand, it's true that the 2014 Rahul Gandhi is very different from the 2019 Rahul Gandhi. So that there is going to be some positive emotion going for the Gandhis at this point of time, especially with Priyanka Gandhi coming in. So that is there. But again, these are muted things. Ultimately, what will matter in these elections are strategic alliances. So this is not an emotional election. This is going to be a nuts and bolts emotion. So last time it was, a grand crescendo. It's like the ending of Hum Dil De Chuke Sanam. It's like a lot of emotion, over emotion. Okay. This time it's like an Anurag Kashyap movie. Okay. It's going to be dirty. It's going to be nuts and bolts. It's going to be realistic. It's going to be the way Indian politics actually is. It's not about overarching. I mean, there's some amount of emotion, but it's not going to be an emotional, it's not an emotional election. It is about caste alliances. It's about who gets the people out. It's going to be on who has the better on-ground game, who has chosen the candidates. And so choosing the candidates is like putting on an IPL team, deciding, you know, who gets what role. You know, as you see, Bangalore does it consistently wrong. So it's about that. It's that kind of an election. It doesn't make it any the less fascinating. But this is elections as elections always used to be. The 2014 election, the 1985 election, there was 1985 or 86, whichever the one that Rajiv Gandhi won. These were aberrations. These are not really the normal Indian elections. This election will be a pretty normal Indian election. There will be definitely be, I believe there will be a fractured mandate. Whether BJP loses power is another thing, but they're definitely the Congress and their allies are going to have a lot more votes. Definitely Uttar Pradesh will go to the Mahagathbandhan. So there will always be these what our media mavens like to call permutations and combinations. I never really understand that. Do you even know what permutations and combinations are? What do you mean by permutations and combinations? I mean, does it matter that which order they are in? So do you know the difference between permutation? I hate that word, permutations and combinations. But whatever, permutations and combinations. So the permutations and combinations that will be formed, it's going to be like, you know, in the early 1990s. You're going to have like people like Devi Lal. You're going to have people like Chandrasekhar. You're going to have these like regional satraps emerging. I'm not an expert. You tell me, what do you think KCR can be? But somebody like KCR, for instance, if he can bring a sufficient number of votes, if he's sure of a sufficient number of votes, he could be a big kingmaker.
We are going to have lots of kingmakers, right? I mean, right from Mamata to in UP. And of course, you have, you know, Biju Patnaik. You have KCR, and Tamil Nadu is a big question mark this time. Nobody knows how it's going to go.
Yeah, and after seeing Naveen Patnaik's exercise regimen, man, it was like scary stuff, man. That was like really intense. It was P90X redone. Anyway.
Before we move on from elections, one final thing. So I noticed something really strange in the one of the FM ads here in Hyderabad. So considering that, you know, we have a lot of, I don't know if migrant is the right term, but you have people from other states who have moved on to Hyderabad for understandably the IT jobs or the opportunities here. I saw quite a few ads which are explicitly targeting them. Talking, you know, so these are in the Hindi FM channels where they talk about saying, you know what, you have a bunch of, North Indian stereotypes talking, saying, you know what, last time when I went to Delhi, people keep asking me about the development in Hyderabad, blah, blah, blah. So the kind of specific micro-targeting of various constituencies, I mean, of various demographics, I never saw this in the previous elections.
Yes,
I think it cements the point you were trying to make, that this is more of a nuts and bolts election where people have to go after each and every subsegment of voters and try to mop everything up.
Absolutely. I believe that's the thing from 2014, where there was a overarching narrative. Now every vote is going to be fought for. So now they're going for I'm sure there's going to be the similar something in Bangalore, where you have so many people from outside Bangalore. So it's not going to be just be targeted towards native Bangaloreans. There's going to be so many people who now form, you know, a really big block of votes who are voting in Bangalore, but they look through the world through the prism of Delhi or through the prism of Calcutta. So they have to be targeted, and it's pretty significant. And people now understand that, you know, if you're going for this, these people can either be migrant workers or they can be, you know, IT code coolies. It doesn't matter who they are, but all of them now come with a social network. Everybody now is evaluated in terms of the social network. So when you get one vote, you get that guy to kind of diffuse his emotion to his social network. It could be 1,000, it could be 2 people. So you're absolutely right. It shows that this election is going to be a battle for every vote. Every vote is going to count. Every seat is going to count. Everything that the BJP has done in terms of marginalizing some people in their party, they might have had a reason for it, but whatever it is, all of those things are going to come to haunt them. Because, you know, last time in 2014, the Modi wave was so strong that it totally blew out the kind of core constituencies that regional satraps, even within the BJP, had. But now they will come into play. Now they will wish they had Shatrughan Sinha's constituency. It might not be a huge constituency in India terms, but at least he can bring one seat in. it will be a battle for seats. Every individual seat will be battled for. And it's fascinating. This is the way elections have always been. I think this is a far more exciting election. I mean, I'm not a politician, not invested in any political party, but as an election watcher and as a lover of drama, of course, there might be a lot of coalition drama, but I think that this is going to be an election that will keep on giving. And I'm not talking about daru bottles and blankets, which also will be given.
Or if Ravi Shastri could put it, this is going to go down to the wire.
This will definitely go down to the wire, and the cat will be out of, will be among the pigeons also.
Okay, Arnab, we've got a few questions coming in. So I thought what we could do starting maybe from this episode is at the end of every episode, I could come up, show you a couple of questions which have come in from our listeners, either through WhatsApp or on Twitter. And, let's start off with one we have for this week, which completely changes gears. Now, just to our listeners who don't know yet, we do have a WhatsApp number. That's 965257833. That's 965257 STUFF. And if you're outside India, make sure you add +91 as the country code, and you can send in your questions, and I'll make sure that Arnab gets to see them. So, Arnab, I think we've got time for one question this week, and this one completely changes gears. So we've been talking all about the Indian elections, and it's going to take you back to where you are. And we don't have the name of the person who's written it in, so please do write in your name as well. And he asks, could you talk about the elite college admission scandal that hit the US last week? I cannot believe the brazenness of it all. So for folks like me who don't know what this is about, could you also cap it up for us?
Yeah, sure. So what happened was a few weeks ago, there was this college admission scandal in which it came to light based on a federal investigation that several very rich people had bribed people inside the universities to admit their sons and daughters, in the sense that, what kind of bribe? Well, let's say you never play volleyball, but the coach in the team, the coach of the university certifies that you are a great volleyball prospect, even though you haven't touched a volleyball in your life. And in the US admission system, much more than in India, where effectively it's the marks you got and whatever, it's the marks you got in your board exams plus the marks you got in your entrance exam, weighted in any shape or form. In the US, your admissions, your scores are a very minor component of that when it comes to admission, especially in the elite institutions. So things like exceptional talent in something, it doesn't necessarily mean that you'll represent in US in volleyball or something, but they look at somebody exceedingly good in anything, no matter how insignificant it might sound to you, as a sign that this person is special. Which means, of course, that this can be gamed. So, several people, including two, C-level Hollywood actresses, were found. Nobody big, but even they make a lot of money. So, they were found basically bribing coaches and bribing administrators to say that, again, this is not like the question papers. The question papers do not need to get leaked because it's not based on marks. But in terms of creating this overall profile of a candidate, that some of their most significant things which kind of set them apart were all false, and they were basically bought by bribing people inside the university. So that was really the synopsis of what happened. Now, my opinion about that is that in India, we've always known about capitation fees. One of the best things about the US is that they're pretty much as corrupt as we are. Of course, corruption is a function of the humanity. Human beings are corrupt to an extent. But the good thing about America, when I say good, I mean in the sarcastic way, is that they make everything legal. So lobbying is basically legalized bribing. And in the US, especially in the elite institutions, donations have been, they're not, capitation fees carry, nobody wants to talk about it. and it happens, but it happens underneath the table. In the US, it doesn't happen underneath the table. You go ahead and if you're monstrously rich, you go and donate to the university. And how do you think that people like George Bush Jr. Get into Yale? How do you think Trump, gets into, I think, Harvard? How do you think that happens? Doesn't happen because of their grades. Again, the thing with American college admissions is that they are not predicated on grades. So they don't even have to keep the facade that, oh, this guy is better than this guy because this guy got 98 and you got 97.5. That is not the way Americans do things. So the Americans say that, your candidature is evaluated based on a number of factors. And they have never made secret of the fact that how your family supports the university is a factor. So effectively, the super rich have always been able to buy their way into college. All you have to do is dedicate a professorship, a professorship seat. If you're more rich, you finance the building. If you look at Stanford, the computer science building is Gates Building. So you know who paid for it. So most of the major universities, the buildings are all in the names of extremely rich people. So this is fairly standard in the US. Now, what these guys did was they wanted to do a Desi version of that. They said, oh man, God, that takes a lot of money. So let's not do that, which we can do legally. Let's do something which is slightly more budget. So again, none of these celebrities were like major. They were not like Tom Hanks. Okay. Tom Hanks can buy a building. But these guys were not that rich. So they said, let's bribe the coach. Okay, so we can't really go and make an endowment to the university which would, give us that power to get our son or daughter in. So let's just go and bribe the coach and try to get in much cheaper. So really, ultimately, the scandal was that they were trying to get their children into college much cheaper than they should have. So the law wasn't that you shouldn't pay. The law was how much you should pay. And people have been paying their way into elite colleges in the US for years, and it's considered to be absolutely legal. And the US education system, by the way, many people think that it's amazing, but it is in many ways. But the way they do it is they say that they work in a very different, there's a very different paradigm from, in India, we kind of look at merit. We say, okay, the best students should go to college. The best students should go to the best colleges. In the US, they don't say that. They say that, every college batch has to be diverse. It has to constitute people from different sections of society. Overall, so this has been now before when social justice was not considered to be a big thing. The parameters that were chosen were excessively wealth. So it was how influential is your father? Is your father a donor to the university? Does your father, like when you say donor, there are multiple levels of donors. Some people have endowments, which are $1 million endowments given to universities. Just go Google and see the amount of endowments Harvard has or the amount of endowments Stanford had. You'd be amazed. They have more savings than small countries. So that was one way you could buy for eternity. People made sure, oh, this guy's last name. Oh, guess what? The computer science building or the electrical engineering building is in his grandfather's name. So obviously he is going to get admitted. Then there were other lesser levels of patronage. So you could basically make donations, which would not be announced, but you could make significant donations. You could, because American, I went to Stony Brook, the Stony Brook Alumni Association amazingly finds me every time I change. Like when I went from Maryland to Illinois to California, they always find where my latest address is and send me appeals to donate money to Stony Brook. Okay, so they're very, very good in really finding people like us who move from different places, and they can locate us all the time. So you can imagine how much money they spend to just locate me. This doesn't happen for free. So they send out these mass mailers asking us to donate to our university. So this is, and what do I get for donating? So if I look at it, I will get things like, oh, if you donate this amount, then you can come and attend this, dinner that we are doing for Stony Brook alumni. This is fairly standard, by the way, so I'm not picking on my own university. So, and for higher levels of pay, when you pay more, you get more access. You might get a dinner with the university president, and you become part of the system. So obviously, without it being made explicit, your family is on a fast track to that university, should you choose to exercise it. Again, what's happened in this case is they have bribed coaches. They have tried to get around that system with not something which is radically different in principle to the system, but just way cheaper. So I didn't find it particularly shocking. I think many people have reacted to it in the same way that I have, that what we should really be concerned about is the very system in which this is allowed. This is not illegal. And again, this is a point which I was kind of losing in a train of thought, was that now, of course, with a greater awareness of social justice in campuses, they are now extending this. This used to be predominantly be money and some marks, but money, how good you were in sports, because sports is very important in US, in the US education system. It's important because for the same reason that you want to be in a city which has a good IPL team. You don't want to be in Bangalore. You want to be in Chennai. So students gravitate, that is, they pay tuition to universities who have good sports teams, so that they can always on the winning team. They feel good. They feel emotional about it, rather than, you know, being in an university which always loses. So the sports has always been very important to US universities, but that was a traditional metric by which people got admitted into, particularly the elite institutions, is that, you know, how wealthy your family is. Yeah, your test scores count for a little bit, not much. You know, how exceptional you are. And much of this, you know, being exceptional was essentially a function of the first point as to how great your family is. Like if Rahul Gandhi was applying to a university, he would say, oh, my, you know, we've had prime ministers all, you know, all through my lineage. Plus, I got voted the president of the Congress Party. Now, you realize that this achievement is linked to the first achievement, right? They're not independent achievements. But that will count for two. If Rahul Gandhi was going for college admissions, they would think that the second thing happened because of some inherent quality he had rather than the last name he inherited. And of course, there's a valid critique for this. And so now we are moving. And this is a good thing, I would say, to an extent. Of course, some people might say it's gone to the other extreme, but that now in many, especially in many of the elite institutions, they're looking at other things. They're not just looking for rich kids, but they're also looking for poor kids. They're looking for racial diversity. They're looking for gender diversity. They're saying, we don't care really about how much somebody got in a test. We want to make sure that our classes represent the diversity of this country. And this means that people from all places are going. So you will find in many places that has been that, this is actually a source of great frustration to NRI parents, because they obviously struggle with this. So my son got like 98 out of 100. Why isn't he getting into Harvard? But it doesn't matter in Harvard. This is not the way things work nowadays in the US. So you have a choice. Either you donate $1 million to Harvard, or you send your son to Boston University. So you have a choice there. Again, no disrespect meant to Boston University, but you get the point. So really, that's really my, I mean, I was not shocked by it, I think, but the good thing about this was it kind of brought this conversation out into the open. People were talking about that, you know what, these guys did try to game the system, but the biggest scandal is not what they did, but the fact that this exists at all, that, you know, how much money you donate to the university is even considered a factor in admissions, which means you essentially can buy your way into a good school. The criminal thing they did was they tried to get a discount. That was the problem.
Okay. So that's our podcast for today, I guess. We will be taking more audience questions on every episode going forward, ideally, Arnab. So we'll ask for the viewers to write in their questions. But we hope you enjoyed this episode as much as we did in making it. And can I again remind you about two other podcasts which we have? What's Up Geeks and Binge On. What's Up Geeks breaks down technology and helps you with your tech life. And Binge On answers the question, what do we watch on TV? as for the podcast that we are listening to right now. You can send in your questions to appodcast@talkingstuff.net or WhatsApp us at 96525-7833 and let us know what you liked and what you didn't. And also, can I remind you about Arnab's Patreon account? That's patreon.com/greatbong, G-R-E-A-T-B-O-N-G. But you already knew that. So that's it for this week. Arnab, any parting words of wisdom?
No, I mean, little IPL thing that Andre Russell innings, I unfortunately could not enjoy because I play fantasy cricket and that night I forgot to make my changes. So absolutely screwed. I had it in my browser. I forgot to press submit. So my double point player was Andre Russell and my 1.5 point player was Virat Kohli and I just forgot to press the button. I would have destroyed the league that day, but unfortunately I couldn't. So it was not personally a great moment for me. So I didn't feel emotional to use the theme of this podcast, but I'm very happy. I'm feeling very happy now to be a KKR fan. I don't know how much happy you are being an SRH fan right now.
Well, yeah, last night wasn't too good. But I did book a ticket for the KKR match at home and also for the Punjab one. I think so. Those are the two matches I'll be going to this year.
Okay, that's great.
I was about to go to yesterday's match, but thankfully I didn't. Perfect. Okay. So thanks all and see you next week.